Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
It's 6 minutes after 6 o'clock. Hello and welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jimmy Moyaha on this 29th day of July. Thank you very much for choosing us. Here's what you can look forward to. We take a look at South Africa's digital fraud crisis. It is deepening. We're going to find out why and how in a few moments. Thalia Patousis is a portfolio manager with Allan Gray. She's going to be talking to us about what fiscal debt traps mean for long-term investors. We're also going to be taking a look at results from Valterra and profiling Dr. Tumelo Chaka in our executive lounge feature. He is the CMO of United Stations. But first, we check how the markets have performed today. David Shapiro is standing by.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
Chief Global Equity Strategist David Shapiro at Otto 1890. A very good evening to you and thank you very much for joining us. So taking a look at our markets, at least risk on, appetite save for financials. But I'd like for us to start with the Rand because it is a little bit down today, though it is pointing to a flirt with the 17 Rand mark. How should we understand this move?
Yeah, it's all to do with what's happening in the U.S. There's still a lot of tensions that are bothering markets. Oil price up and down. We don't know where we are with Iran. You know, you have absolutely no idea what Trump's doing, whether he's attacking, whether he's holding back. And it just causes a lot of uncertainty. The oil price comes down $10, you know, and then the next minute it's up $10. And against this kind of backdrop, it's very difficult for investors to look ahead, you know. So, we've had AI, which has been a massive driver of markets for the last 4 years. The story is getting a bit old. Well, I don't want to say it's getting old. It's spreading out. But, you know, you have to understand somewhere down the line, we want to go back to an environment where you've got growth, you know, where we're normalizing, where we're not relying on technology to get us through this. Because while oil prices remain high and we've got another Fed meeting happening now, we're waiting for the results in about an hour or two's time. Fed Governor Walsh will report. But there are deep concerns about inflation. Will rates keep going up? They started to come down, a year ago or something like this. Until we got the wars in Iran, and so oil's gone up, and now it's another threat. We really thought we were going to have further decreases. So it's a messy environment, very very messy, and it's very hard to kind of navigate your way through that until we get some steadiness in the global economy and return to growth.
I hear you a lot because some sectors of the population argue that instability is the new normal, David, when you look at what is happening and the momentum that we are seeing right now. When we take a look at, you mentioned what's happening in the U.S. in terms of us waiting for the rate decision, all eyes on Kevin Walsh, the tension is palpable as reflected on the S&P and the NASDAQ. Where do you see it going?
Well, look, we're in summer season, and there is a lot of nervousness. But and as I say, it's not only Walsh, it's not only the oil price, but every time a propeller head in China invents something in the basement, his basement, you know, the whole world goes backward. Competition and so on. So you start to see these massive sell-offs. Dude, I must tell you, a couple of weeks ago, and you've been around, we had everybody wanting SpaceX, you know, Elon Musk's SpaceX. You couldn't get enough shares. The share price went to $225. A couple of weeks later, it's half the price now at $112. SK Hynix, the same thing, the Korean semiconductor company, also listed on NASDAQ, you know, to a huge fanfare and a lot of demand. That went up all the way to 195. Now people can't get rid of their SK Hynix. You know, the share price has come back to 130. And that's in America. In Korea, it's just collapsing. So those are the kind of movements we're having to deal with on almost a day-to-day basis. So it's very volatile, very nervous, very uncertain. And I think a lot, there are the concerns that there's overspending on rolling out infrastructure for AI and companies are never going to get their money back as well. But I only think that's a reaction to concerns in the market, you know, looking for excuses to take profits and that. I think we're far away from, you know, from any major issues there. But all I'm trying to identify is this is what we have to trade in. You know, this is the kind of news that you have to try and explain to people. Not easy.
Not at all. Not at all. All right, let's come back home and look at the top 40. So resources after 2 days of losses, stronger today. We take a look at Glencore's production report. It reads positive. Valterra, an earnings beat. Kumba doing well in spite of a tough operating environment. Then ArcelorMittal's trading update today, expecting earnings to drop without anticipating what we will hear tomorrow. Given the demand driven by renewables, what's happening with ArcelorMittal?
Oh, it's struggling. You know, it's struggling because there's no economy. there's no demand here. It's the one area of the market that's very concerning. You know, if you looked at Kumba's results, which are produces iron ore, which goes into steel, prices are down, demand is slower, and that's because of China. They're not building roads and buildings anymore. But then you compare it, and this is where the difference comes in, is that if you listen to Rio Tinto's numbers this morning, okay, they're not listed here, but results very good. Why? Because demand for copper, aluminium, and I'm trying to think of the third part of it, which all have to do with AI. But I think that's where the, you know, so there's a lot of growth in those areas of the market that are associated with, you know, with the development of AI. So, you know, from that point of view, there's still hope, you know, there's still some good aspects of our market. We did see gold and platinum coming down a bit here as well. Valterra's results are very, very good. The share price is on the down. They're generating a lot of cash and they're paying good dividends. But it's choppy at the moment. The platinum price has come down now below 1600. And I think as time goes by, the benefits that they got will start to be diluted, you know, from last year. But nevertheless, don't write off the commodity side of this market against the backdrop of you know, against the backdrop of huge AI expenditure, and the use of metals, you know, and also you've got the fertilizer side of it as well, which is, you know, which helps BHP, which helps Anglo. So you know, there are positive areas in that side of the market.
Absolutely. And maybe we can add what the just energy transition as well as we build out to greener energy resources. I wonder if you got to check out Mercedes-Benz. So they came out with a second quarter update. Revenue for the group slightly below last year with a reduction of sales in China. When you spoke of low demand, it sort of like sparked that. This is a very interesting market or industry, if you will, because in Germany they're looking to lay people off because of cheap electric vehicles from China. How should we read their update?
With care. It's the competition is intensifying, and you can see it in our own market now, where the Mercedes agencies have kind of halved their space. Simply, people are not buying those cars because of the cheap imports of Chinese vehicles. Not only that, it's also the battle for electric cars. You know, who's going to win it? It's not the technology is completely different. That's not that Mercedes aren't great technologists or not doing well, but demand for the BMWs, for the Mercedes falling, you know, in place of in place of electric vehicles, particularly from, or vehicles generally from China. Strangely, in America, where they don't buy Chinese cars, you know, there's very, in fact, very limited market. I don't even know if you can get a Chinese car there. But there, Ford came out with some very good numbers now. A lot of SUVs, you know, demand up for SUVs because their shares are up in one of the features today in on Wall Street. I'm just trying to look where Ford up 5.5% there. So, but this is it's it's a tough market for Mercedes.
It is indeed. Just before we let you go, Remgro, that stock is down 0.9%. 91 acquiring a beneficial interest in Remgro. Is this material at all?
Not really.
Okay.
But it is it is looking attractive simply because I think Remgro are starting to use their muscle a little and starting to look very attractive with the businesses they're developing. They went to sleep for a few years, but starting to look, you can do that down in Somerset West or down in Stellenbosch. You can get a bit lazy there, but I mean, it's starting to look very attractive again,
right.
And hence the 91's involvement.
Got you. And for those who are interested, the price of Brent crude, $90 a barrel. That's up 7% at least today. Thank you very much, David. Always a pleasure to chat to you. David Shapiro, Chief Global Equity Strategist at Otto 1890.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
For decades, developed market government bonds have been the cornerstone of global fixed income portfolios. But with government debt levels rising and fiscal deficits widening, are long-held assumptions about sovereign debt being challenged? This evening at 6:45, Thalia Patousis, portfolio manager at Allan Gray, joins SAFM Market Update to discuss why developed market borrowing costs are under pressure and explore where long-term investors are finding value in the global fixed income universe. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Land of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
The Public Investment Corporation, which manages investments on behalf of public sector funds, has been bedeviled by a number of very public challenges, including a lack of leadership that has tainted its reputation. Africa's largest asset manager is now looking to appoint suitable service providers to A, implement and provide HR solutions for a period of 5 years, and another one to provide culture change interventions for 2 years. This after an internal survey found the organization culture was poor, leading to low staff morale and distrust. Deboho Gas is the chairperson of Public Interest South Africa. Thank you very much, sir, for availing yourself this evening. So when you saw the RFQs, you thought what?
Well, it just shows you the heat wave in terms of governance within the organization that just gotten to a point where it is not only a contested terrain, but also emotionally draining, as the RFQs suggest. And you ask yourself why it took this long after the commissions that actually focus on Mpati Commission. I think that's all the one that focus on the PAC. But it will require a lot more than just surveys or at the end of the day, I think political interference is just as palpable. And I think this is what it reeks of at the PAC. And it doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon.
I don't even know how to frame this question, but I'd like for us to look at the cost of this, because the RFQs do not have a price, right? So therein embedded in the RFQs that the service provider must provide a price, if you will. This could possibly run into the millions of rands. Did it have to get this far, especially when you speak of political interference?
Look, the cynic in me says what's the use of having undertaking such a costly exercise when we all know where the problem may largely be? Because you'd recall Tito Mboweni once proposed that the governance structure of the PIC not be constituted in the manner that it is currently, where you have the deputy minister being required to chair, or somebody that in the finance cluster being the nominated chair of the PIC, when we know very well that politicians themselves, where there's money and politics, you'll always find problems. And those decisions made at the PIC are heavily influenced by the political climate. And to the extent that we see these divisions even within, the ANC is no longer the ruling party, but they've got control of the finance clusters in the government of national unity. But it also externally outside of PIC, because if you look at the funds that they manage for over 1.7 million pensioners or government employees, you realize that the entity responsible for that, the GEPF, that investment, which is more than 70%, I believe, of the money in under management by the PIC, they are also politicized. You look at the chairperson of GEPF, he's a former unionist, a staunch ally of Ramaphosa. His wife is also in the presidency. And you ask yourself, should we be surprised if we see the kind of shenanigans happening at the PIC, where might is right, where those who've got political might or leverage do not, you know, hesitate to use it. And that peters through or filters through to the normal general employees within PIC, who can see that it doesn't matter what they do, what matters most is who's in charge of the till. And this is not the right way to go. So the environment will still remain toxic and not conducive, no matter how much money they spend and from whomever they spend. I don't want to also be cynical and say maybe it's another opportunity for somebody else to also pick up some money.
I'm on the PIC website, and on their values, they read, these are just some of them: transparency, open reporting and clear decision making so stakeholders can trust what we do, respect, we treat people, communities and partners with dignity and empathy, accountability, we own outcomes, learn from results and act to improve performance, lead by example, we set the standard through our behavior and operational excellence, integrity, we act ethically and transparently in every decision we make. And then you look at the scope for the intervention in terms of the service provider, some of the items that they name that they want the service provider to provide is fostering psychological safety and trust, including facilitation of the employee healing process, executive and leadership alignment, facilitation of courageous conversations, behavioral change and adoption example, personal and team mastery, and so it goes. It's from A to K, these this scope and these points. And so when you take a look at what's on their website and what they are looking for, it is similar. There is a disconnect between paper and practice. While this may be a needed intervention, maybe a consequence management company is needed more than anything, no?
You know, I'll pick just two of the many things that you mentioned that is on their website. Let's take transparency and good governance. You know, the two go hand in glove. Good governance requires two principles to coexist. You know, we now know that the PIC is in the throes of a whistleblower report. And you ask yourself, what is going to happen? Are the interests of the whistleblowers, of the content of the whistleblower, being dealt as transparently, as honestly, as courageously as they should? Instead, we see a rugby ball or a soccer ball being passed around instead of looking at the issues themselves, including what we now know about the PwC report, which hasn't seen the light of day, which is reportedly damning on the conduct of some of the people within the whistleblower. So if you cannot protect those who shine a light on wrongdoing, who raise concerns in good faith and safeguarding the rights of individuals against whom allegations are made, it doesn't matter how many surveys or how much you spend or how much on your website you can talk about these lofty ideals. But at the end of the day, it is what, when the tire hits the rubber, sorry, mm-hmm. I hate those expressions, when you realize that there's a disconnect between what they proclaim to be and what they seem to be more concerned about protecting the reputations of the leadership and not getting the leadership to do what is right. Okay. Because we know that there are riddled with accusations which talk to the integrity of the stewardship of the entity. And for me, that is a very big point that I'm not sure if the survey that they want to take, how it's going to be addressed there, because the survey should be the board management survey more than the employee survey. The employees, it would be very easy to know that the employee, wherever they are, they're disillusioned. If you're working for an entity with such governance, in a governance crisis like this, yes, it would help for somebody to come and address you and say, hold it tight, we are still working on this. But you have to work at it. And what working on it is not dissolving a board because put somebody or the CEO on suspension.
Okay, for wrongdoing. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for your contribution this evening. Tebogo Kas is the chairperson of Public Interest South Africa.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system is kinda dear makar. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
It's 28 minutes after 6 o'clock. Thank you very much for staying with the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. So if you partake in online activity like gambling, i.e. sports betting or gaming, this might be for you. In the first quarter of this year, Africa had the highest iGaming fraud rate globally, while South Africa's iGaming fraud more than tripled. That's according to the latest SumSub iGaming report. Jared Jensen is Regional Director for Southern Africa at SumSub. He joins us now on the line for more. Thank you very much, Jared, for your time this evening. Maybe just a brief introduction in terms of how the report was put together.
Yes, good evening. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. So basically, we went and analyzed millions of different activities over the past year. So, of course, as SumSub, a software provider within the space, so of course, KYC compliance and fraud prevention, we analyze a lot of data on an annual basis, and we use that data to actually form the results, or to arrive at the results that we've arrived at and reported on.
Okay. What makes the continent the leading fraud hotspot?
The continent, the leading fraud hotspot at the moment. So, I mean, the biggest thing is that we have actually seen some of the fastest expansion when it comes to digital technology, right? So the thing is, as the technology expands into the hands of more people across the continent, and as the continent continues to grow, of course, the use of digital services becomes more prominent, and therefore a lot of people onboard remotely. And therefore, the opportunities for identity fraud continue to grow too.
Okay. This is what I found scary. In some cases, the fraudster is related to the victim. So they borrow your ID number and try to verify you so that they can gain access and defraud you, essentially. Given that 97% of all iGaming fraud we see coming out of the continent is caught at the liveness stage, what should we understand about that? What does it mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a really good question. And what it means is that liveness is basically when you have to do like a selfie check when you're onboarding to some online application. So, for example, you have to present your face to the camera, and then you obviously need to prove that it's you, and that your face matches the details on your, let's say, identity documents or your data within the government database, et cetera, et cetera. And the majority of fraud is being caught at the liveness stage. It's because the majority of fraudsters are starting to utilize deepfakes to try bypass the verification. So I know we don't have too much time, but basically the way that it works is, let's say I know you in person. We are friends. We've got some photos together, whatever the case may be. I'm over at your house. I have your ID documents, for example. I get access to your details, and I have your face because we have some photos together. And then I actually go and basically swap your face onto my face, but then enhance it to the point where you can't really, as a human, tell the difference. You don't know that it's Jared, right? Mm. You would think that it's Dudazella that's there behind the camera. Mm. So we are catching them at that stage. So yeah, it's crazy though, because most of the times the identity is either like stolen or bought or just like borrowed, and it's just someone trying to pass themselves off as that other person.
Ay. Now we're going crazy to be suspecting each other. Indeed.
Yeah, I know. When we used to
every time somebody asks for a photo going forward, you like think twice. But yeah, no, thank you. It makes it practical, right? So, and it also gives us a tip of what to avoid. You also looked at when attacks happen, and on the continent, the afternoon is popular, which is interesting, because for other markets it's either in the morning or at midday. What does this suggest about the criminals, if anything at all?
Yeah, well, you know what, the thing is, they try to blend in with most of the traffic, right? So the majority of traffic is generally going to be outside of working hours. So it's generally going to either be like early mornings prior to like business hours, or it's going to be in the evenings when everyone is online, everyone's logging in, everyone's doing something. And they blend in with that noise, right? So the more noise there is, the easier it is for them to try slip through the cracks. And that's pretty much what I mean. It's kind of subjective though, right? But I mean, it's more of an observation that we've made.
Got you. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we can afford, but I'd really encourage our listeners to check out the report, SumSub iGaming report. So SumSub, you spell SumSub iGaming report. You can find it on their website. Jared Jensen is Regional Director for Southern Africa at SumSub. Thank you.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
This segment is brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. So for some time now, developed market government bonds were regarded as among the safest assets available to investors. However, that assumption is being challenged, with many developed economies facing a very different reality. Government borrowing costs in countries such as the United States, the United Kingdom, France and Germany have risen to levels last seen before the global financial crisis, while debt burdens and fiscal deficits have expanded significantly. As investors begin to question the sustainability of rising government debt, important implications are emerging for sovereign bond markets and long-term asset allocation decisions. Allan Gray portfolio manager Thalia Patousis joins us now to discuss why developed market borrowing costs have risen so sharply and what growing fiscal deficits and debt burdens in developed markets mean for long-term investors. Thalia, thank you very much for your time this evening. And maybe let's start that and use that as our point of departure. What should we understand about this trend? Why are developed market government borrowing costs rising to levels not seen in almost two decades?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'd say the very simple answer is that it is due to government overspending. And I would say this government-owned overspending isn't something new, in the sense that so government borrowing costs, you know, as you mentioned, in US and parts of Europe, you know, they're at levels we haven't seen in 15 to 20 years. The last time we saw these kind of borrowing yields was in 2007. Now, what came very soon after was the 2008 global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of a big turning point for sovereign debt burdens. So governments at the time, they were engaging in a lot of emergency spending. They were trying to stabilize the financial system. They were trying to bail out troubled financial institutions and banks. And then they were also trying to support consumers through, you know, expanded unemployment benefits, welfare programs, and so on. But the issue was, you know, this economic stimulus was not short-lived. And actually, in an effort to limit any form of economic pain, ultimately for the electorate, the governments, you know, that we've kind of outlined, perhaps with the exception of Germany, they never stopped overspending in the period since. And that's actually quite extraordinary, because if you look at the longer history of government debt markets, and even just a shorter history, you know, if you cast your eye back to the early 1990s, the U.S. was borrowing quite excessively. They had, you know, a mild recession. They experienced the first Iraq war. And yet, relatively soon after, so in the latter part of the 1990s, they were able to curb that overspending. So what did they do? They put through tax increases. They put through legislative spending caps. They started to really reduce their defense spending as well. Mm-hmm. But we haven't seen that same reining in of spending as penance for past excesses since then. And in fact, what we've seen is following the COVID-19 pandemic, so the next, you could say, a big recession to hit, governments responded with an even higher degree of overspending than during the global financial crisis. And none in the developed world has really returned to their pre-COVID-19 deficit levels. So I would say they've become addicted to overspending. And, you know, as a result of all this overspending, government debt markets are seeing this huge supply of paper that investors are being forced to take up. And as, you know, their borrowing rises, so do their borrowing costs, because investors just can't take up the large supply of debt that's continuously hitting the market.
I'd like for us to expand on this rising borrowing costs, right? Because they've earned the title of a sovereign debt trap. Just talk to our listeners about that concept, and maybe you can explain to us why investors are paying closer attention to fiscal sustainability.
Yeah, so the notion of a sovereign debt trap, you know, how I think about it is really it's when your interest bill, you know, as a sovereign is compounding, so growing much faster than tax revenue growth. Mm-hmm. Because that means it's crowding out the government's ability to meet other spending needs, you know, recurrent spending obligations, social welfare, etc. And maybe just for the audience, you know, another way to think about it is, you know, we're all familiar with the concept of taking out a loan or taking out mm-hmm. a mortgage. Really, what's happening with these governments is, you know, you have to service the interest, let's say, on a mortgage. And then, you know, once you've done that, you can start paying down the principal. Well, firstly, they're not paying down the principal, but then also they're actually borrowing more just in order to cover the interest payments. So that's another way of thinking about a sovereign debt trap. It's just your interest bill is compounding so much faster, you cannot even meet those commitments. And even excluding the interest bill, you're running an in-year deficit. So the issue is just compounding very quickly. And I think why investors, I think most investors will have been aware of these dynamics, but I think in recent, very recent years, maybe since 2022, what's happened is what's added fuel to the fire here is we've had reasonably high inflation in developed markets. And that means that those interest rates have started to rise in some cases, you know, faster than the growth rate of the economy. So it's just this compounding effect, and it's this larger supply of debt that's hitting the markets. And we're essentially at something of a tipping point, and you can see that in what's happening on borrowing costs.
What then does this mean for long-term investors, especially allocating capital across global fixed income markets?
So it's an interesting question. I think what it means for investors, and particularly investors in developed markets, sovereign debt markets, and I mean, they will have already experienced this, is that these are not proving to be great investments. I think you said at the onset, and these are the, you know, these are considered the safest investments one can get. You know, the U.S. Treasury and U.S. government bonds are often referred to as the risk-free rates. Now, you would expect that if you're investing in something that's the risk-free rate, you know, you're going to make a reasonable return. But actually, if you as an investor had allocated $100 in 2009 to various offshore developed market bonds, you would have experienced, you know, a dismal 17 years worth of return since. And in fact, it's only so Germany's sovereign debt markets would have at least allowed you to just about preserve the value of your capital. And again, I use the example of $100. So you would have preserved your capital in dollar terms after adjusting for inflation. But actually, if you invested in U.S. Treasury bonds, you would have lost 7% worth of your inflation-adjusted capital over the coming period. Mm-hmm. So you would not have made a positive return. And then it's even your return experience would have been even worse in the UK, France, and Japan. You know, if you invested in Japanese debt markets, again, putting that $100 into the market in 2009, you would have now at this point lost more than 60% of your capital. So for every, you know, you'd have $40 essentially remaining in inflation-adjusted terms.
Right.
So they haven't proved to be great pockets for investing. And in fact, what we found, and it's a surprising takeaway for a lot of investors, is you haven't had such a dreadful return experience in African sovereign debt and even South African sovereign debt by comparison. And that surprises people. Mm. And maybe I'll just briefly say, I mean, the reasons why I think it is very often, you know, our markets, being in South Africa or broader Africa region, they're not priced for success. So you come in at really high yields, you earn very high coupons. There's a lot of investor fear, and those kind of high yields compound over time. So we're not priced like a risk-free sovereign. And then another reason is actually in more recent years, especially in the last 5 or so years, you've seen a lot of African sovereigns, including South Africa, actually be far more fiscally prudent in their budgeting process than in years past. So you're not seeing the same, you know, degree of overspending and this fiscal largesse and, you know, this caving to populist demands for unbridled spending, because we've learned these very difficult lessons.
Yeah.
And I don't think developed markets have learned such difficult lessons as yet, because they haven't had the experience of investors actually closing their door to them.
Whereas
we have had experiences where foreign investors have said, well, we, you know, unwilling to refinance your debt, we're going to completely disinvest, or whatever it might be, maybe not completely. But yeah, so I would say that's been the impact on investors.
That's very fascinating, because that too then challenges that risk assumption that is exclusive, if you will, quote unquote, to the continent. Thalia Patousis is Allan Gray Portfolio Manager. Thank you. This segment was brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. With over 5 decades of investing experience, Allan Gray remains focused on building long-term wealth for clients by pursuing long-term returns without taking undue risk. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to the Market Update on SAFM.
We're shy of 16 minutes until the hour of 7 o'clock, actually. Let's just focus on to this. So the world's largest platinum producer by value, Valterra Platinum Group, has delivered a masterclass on how to let the work speak for itself through their results for the year ending June 30. Between January to June, profit margins increased significantly, driven by stronger prices within the platinum group, as well as elevated production and sales. Headline earnings per share increased to 82.02 rand from 4.73 rand. That's a 1,633% jump compared to the previous period. Revenue increased 94% to 82 billion rand, and adjusted EBITDA margin rose fourfold to 33.4 billion rand. Craig Miller is the CEO of Valterra. He joins us on the line for more. What a breathtaking set of results, Craig. You've recorded growth across all key financial metrics. Were you surprised?
Good evening, Didi. Surprised, maybe not, but incredibly proud of what the team have been able to accomplish in the 6 months. And I think it just highlights the real value that we all see in our business and our ability to be able to really create sustainable value for all of our stakeholders.
Congratulations. Let's take a look at the operational performance, and you can talk us through production and sales. What did you witness there?
Yeah, so production from our mines, our own mines, increased 9% in the first half of the year to about 1 million ounces. Our refined production, it increased 25% from last year, and that really is on the back of the recovery from the flooding incident that we had at the beginning of last year, but well as some inventory optimization work that we've been doing because of the stability in our downstream processing, and that translated into 17% increase in sales. And given that platinum group metal prices were up 66% in rand terms, we certainly lent into that higher price environment, and that's translated into the results that we've published today.
So the company's EBITDA margin mining EBITDA margin expanded by 50%. What does that speak to, especially when we look at cost discipline?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been very focused around driving efficiencies within the business, and you would have seen today. So despite inflation rising, inflation in our business is around 7%. 1% of that is because of the conflict in the Middle East. We've been able to offset that with efficiencies across the entire value chain. So very focused around driving further cost savings, and we're going to realize more energy savings in the second half of the year as our renewable energy program comes through. But more importantly, just operating the assets more stably and really focused around value. And that will help propel us into, I think, a good financial position for the whole of 2026.
You are sitting with a very strong balance sheet. How did the investment grade debt note program actually contribute to the results?
Yes, so we issued 2 billion rands of debt notes earlier in the year. The benefit of that is it was our inaugural bond issuances, so we certainly went into the market. But the benefit of that is our interest cost is about 1 percentage point lower than what we currently have. But so that left us at the half year with about 55 billion rand of facilities. Because of the strong operating and financial performance, we're able to finish the half year with about 24 billion rand worth of cash on the balance sheet, which has enabled us to pay the 15 billion rand out in an interim dividend payable to shareholders at the end of August.
Unfortunately, you were not incident-free. What sort of measures have been put in place to deal with this?
Yeah, so tragically, we have had 3 fatalities during the first half of the year. We're incredibly saddened by that, and we're doubling our efforts to really ensure that we can achieve zero harm across the operation. So we've strengthened some of our procedures. We're certainly looking at how we deal with risk in our business and how we mitigate that and take people out of harm's way. But most importantly, looking to continue to simplify ways of operating so that our team members can be in the front and supervisors can be in the front line engaging with our team members at the rock face, and ultimately looking to protect people and ensure that they go home safely every single day.
The PGM market in this period experienced a substantial recovery. I look at the price of platinum today, it's down 1.3%. As we look ahead, if you will, what can we really expect? Is it a fair question?
Yes, no, I think it's perfectly valid. You're not alone in asking the question.
Great.
Shareholders do and everybody else does. I think from our perspective, yes, certainly we saw a significant rally in prices in the first quarter of the year. They've come off a bit now, but they're still 30% higher than the average for 2025. So a meaningful step up. And I do feel that the prices broadly reflect the underlying demand for PGMs, particularly in the industrial space. You're still seeing really healthy automotive demand outside of China. And then obviously you continue to see sort of investment demand playing itself out. So we have a positive outlook for the market. And then if you underpin that with anticipated deficits in both platinum, palladium and rhodium for the next year or so, palladium much longer, actually we see a deficit into the medium term. That gives us the confidence that PGM prices are expected to remain elevated, and consequently that enables us to invest back into the assets at Valterra Platinum and be disciplined in terms of how we both allocate capital to grow production, but also to return value to shareholders.
Fair enough. Maybe you can just quickly, if you will, please, just talk us through your sustainability efforts.
Yeah, so sustainability is integrated into absolutely everything that we do. And we look at sustainability from both a value creation and a value protection perspective. So we're quite focused around the climate and the environment. And so you'd have seen today that we highlighted the 30% renewable energy supply that we now have into the business, which not only gives us reliable energy, it reduces our costs, and importantly reduces our carbon footprint, which is key to what our customers and what our society is asking us. So particularly focused around that, we're looking at actively ensuring that we achieve carbon neutrality by the end of the next decade, and I'm working with the team to see how we can bring that forward. Similar to that, we also look at supporting our host communities and local communities. And you'd have seen today that we also in the 6 months commissioned a 5 megaliter per day water treatment plant, mm-hmm. which not only reduces our water requirements at our operations, but actually gives the community access to clean water. So it's absolutely integrated into all of our work, and we'll continue to progress that because we do think that is a value protection and a value creation opportunity. And
Craig, well done to you and your team. Craig Miller is the CEO of Valterra Platinum, the world's largest platinum producer by value.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Alrighty, it's Wednesday evening, and that means it's time for our executive lounge feature. And this evening we meet Dr. Tumelo Chaka. He is the Chief Marketing Officer of Media Sales House United Stations. Dr. Chaka is a PhD qualified consumer behavior and marketing academic and strategist. His work sits at the intersection of finance, culture, psychology, and strategy, helping organizations understand how people think, decide and behave in complex, diverse markets, particularly across the continent. Morana, thank you very much for your time this evening and availing yourself. I think maybe let's start with understanding the CMO role. So how should we understand what a chief marketing officer does?
I think, thank you very much, first of all, for having me here. And it's a privilege to be here. So the CMO, for me, I'm thinking about the CMO of the future, because as a CMO of the past, which is just a marketer who does campaigns and puts a brand up there. The CMO of the future for me is somebody who understands the intersection of marketing and finance. Because you've got to bring together the CFO, you've got to bring together the CEO, the COO. So the CMO today for me should be a person who understands the numbers, the science, the art of the game, and who cares about P&L. Because if you don't understand the numbers, I think for me, it's about, because marketing is about building growth and building profitability.
There we go. What's P&L?
Profit and loss.
Ah, okay. There we go. So when we take a look at the core of it, yeah. right? So to drive those sales, you have to think of the person who will be consuming whatever it is that you need to drive those sales. Was it always obvious for you? Maybe you can talk to us about people and the importance of people.
So, and looking back, having been growing up as an introvert, so you're always quiet but watching. Mm. And the more you watch, the more you try to understand. So for me, it was about, and now I've learned these big words as I learned further in life, that not only did I segment, but I was able to hyper-segment. Because you can segment people and say people earn so much money and therefore they belong to this type of lifestyle and therefore they deserve these products. But you have to also hyper-segment. Because just by covering, looking at people and say they earn so much, there's so much in them beyond just money. It's now how they think, where they live, what they eat. I always say three things are very key in South Africa when looking at customers. It's how they travel, what they eat, and who governs them. Because if you look at, most of South Africa lives under kingship land. So who governs them determines how they think and how loyal they are. If you look at how, I remember most of the time, if you see during elections, where do politicians go first? They go to kings. And because they see where people live. And then where they eat. If you look at the strongest, biggest, influential retailers in South Africa are cash and carries. Because that's where the bulk of the country lives in. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, how they travel. Taxis. If you can understand the taxi economy, you can understand how people think, consume, and live. Because it's when they travel, which means when they view ads, what time do they do TV. Some of them at times, people travel with two phones. One is the smartphone that stays at home because of the danger of traveling and losing it during taxi traveling. Mm-hmm. And when they get home, they then take out the smartphone. So if you send an ad through WhatsApp or through any internet-formed communication, it doesn't reach them because they travel with what we call the jarara, those old phones that only just receive SMSs.
Mm. You've also been in the financial services industry.
Yes.
I'd like to understand the common thread, right? So what keeps you, or rather, what is the common thread that has ensured your longevity also in the industry?
So I always say I'm the shotgun of CEOs. I find solutions and I find customer solutions. Mm-hmm. So whether it's, I've worked in financial services, I've worked in media, but the common thing there is how customers think and consume. It's understanding the customer. And if you can understand that, then it's understanding the value proposition that the company is now offering. And then thirdly to that is, how do we make money? How do we sell the product that we make? And for me, that's where I think my strength comes in. I understand people. Understand how people think. And I'd really take time to understand the thought view of people in general, but more importantly, why they spend and where they spend.
Got you. How would you characterize your leadership style?
I've always said I'm a guy that gives people space because I lead the way I want to be led.
Aha.
So I give you space. I believe in the views of people like Steve Jobs. When I have a team, I run a small enterprise. Each person's got their own business in the team. Therefore, you are a CEO of your space. I give you the space to thrive, the space to do what you need, and I become a team member in your space. Therefore, when you think I'm just a boss, no, I'm also a team member in your space, so I can also be led by you because you know more than me. I believe in hiring people that are better than me.
Mm. You were in the room at the Africa CMO 100.
Correct.
For somebody who is looking at entering this industry or who is thinking, even me, you know, one day, I identify with what you're talking about. What was the tone in the room that you can share with somebody to take that forward or to say, okay, maybe there's something that I need to think of?
So I've seen in that room, the tone was about collaboration, one. The tone was about building an Africa that we can all be part of. The tone was, how do we drop the ladder down so that others can come up? Because most of us have been molded by the same people who were in the room. Talk about the Hepin Chingilas, the Tebe. They've molded most of us, in fact, all of us in the room. Because I remember one of the speakers from the CMO from Kaya, her first opening was, "Thank you, Hepi, for giving me an opportunity at Herd Boys."
Manchini.
And many of us can say the same thing about the Tebes,
yeah.
the Sydney Mbeles,
yeah.
the Tabangs. So I believe in the room, those who see themselves as future CMOs, as find a mentor in the current CMOs, because they're giving and they're willing to mentor.
Morena, thank you so much. That's unfortunately all the time we can afford this evening. Dr. Tumelo Chaka is the Chief Marketing Officer of Media Sales House United Stations. And that's it from myself and the team. Thank you very much for joining us. Greg Hose is standing by with the latest news updates. If you missed any of our stories, www.moneyweb.co.za. Have yourselves a fantastic evening. Mahaichu. Bulakio.